8:31. So let us begin.
Okay.
A lot of things to do before we even begin, as always. As I always do, I listened to the tape, and I wasn't clear on something. So let me clarify this. This business that a Kohen is not supposed to duchen if people hate him, what the Mishnah Berurah says, it goes back to Zohar, is it could be a sakana. What does that mean, sakana? I don't know, but it could be dangerous.
Mark, you want to set the
An
date?
ovel, an
You can set the
ovel.
date of the class.
Oh, right, the date.
Sorry about that.
It's okay.
No,
We
it's
mark the
important.
date, but it's
No,
fine.
it's important for posterity, November 30th, 2020. So it says an if a Kohen that the Tzibor hates him or he hates the Tzibor, it's a sakana for the Kohen to do Birkas Kohanim. And that's when I raised the question. I mentioned that the poskim speak about, well, let's say it's they hate him for a good reason. Is that still a danger for him? Now, this issue, if anyone's interested, is discussed in this book by Professor Tushma. Create most of his stuff was in Hebrew, but this is in English. Studied Creativity and Tradition, Studies in Medieval Rabbinic Scholarship on page 193. Because the interesting thing is, there's no rabbinic source for this idea that it's just in the Zohar, the idea that the Kohen, if the people don't like him or if he doesn't like them, it's a danger involved. What Tushma wants to argue is this whole chapter tries to show Germanic Ashkenazic influence on the Zohar. And he wants to say that this, he tries to bring a proof from an Or Zeruah that this passage in the Zohar really is, it's Ashkenazic residue. He has a whole book that deals with Byzantines and other stuff. But this, in the Zohar, this chapter deals with Ashken, what he calls the large residue of Ashkenazic customs and lore in the Zohar. So obviously, Professor Tushma thought the Zohar is a medieval work. That's what he wrote about. Okay. A couple other things. We spoke last class about women's titles. I want to show you something that I just saw this week. Well, hold on, actually. Let me stop sharing this. I think I need to. Yeah, the problem is if it's not on my screen, I got to keep sharing and then giving you a new screen if it's unless it's on the internet. Okay, so there's this newspaper. Everyone in the New York area knows it. It's called the Jewish Link. It's not much of a newspaper. It's mostly one big advertisement. Even the articles, most of them are just you submit them. So the schools submit their articles. And had YU had two big pages this week to try it. Well, here you see it. You have right in the front, Official Schechter. You have I also know Rabbi Leibowitz. If you don't know Rabbi Leibowitz and you're interested in halakha, I highly recommend it. He has thousands of online stuff about 10-minute, 15-minute halakha. He's really spectacular. Also, notice that in the Haredi yeshiva, you never would have this. They all would be wearing hats. We already spoke about that. In the Haredi world, you have to wear a hat anytime you take a picture. So this is, but this is, you have Rav Schechter, and then you have the younger Rosh Yeshiva. He's the most important of the Rosh Yeshiva. And then you have some of the younger ones. Okay, very nice. They're trying to, it's, you know, bringing, it's advertising. But then they have a problem because what do you call the women? So they have the same ad 2 pages later. Oh, hold on. Nope. Well, got to get the, got to share it again. Hold on. Here. So look what they do with the women. Only one of these women, by the way, is an academic, does scholar. The rest are just Torah teachers. They can't give them a title, they can't give them anything. So they call them all professor. Professor doesn't mean you have a doctorate or anything, just means that you are a teacher at the university. But so this is maybe being more conservative, pious, because you don't give the women a title. But on the other hand, it's almost blasphemous because you're using a goyish term, professor, and you're referring to as a for a Torah teacher. So if you ever needed a reason that there should be a title, whatever it is, for women Torah teachers, I think this is it. That we're calling women Torah scholars, the best we could do is give them the goyish title professor. And not to mention the fact that it's false advertising because most people think professor, they think of like an academic type. These are Torah teachers, but YU cannot come up with a title. They can't do any of the titles we spoke about. So they have to call them all professor. which I guess you don't want to call them misses because that's, you know, you want to give them some title, but I have to correct myself. So I was looking through the Jewish link. And remember I said last week, we can't use Rabbanit. That's used in the Israeli schools, but we can't use it. SAR can use it, but not the other schools. Even Kushner won't use Rabbanit. But then I noticed, interestingly, in the Jewish link as well, lo and behold, let me show you something here. Let me pull it up here. There was another ad. Hold on, it's complicated here. Oh, here it is. For the synagogue Renat in Teaneck. And look what they have here. So take back what I said. They're having a advertising their Torah by Zoom. And lo and behold, Rabbanit Leah Sarna. She's actually a Maharat graduate. But Renat, so I guess I take back what I said, that Rabbanit is not used because occasionally you will have the title here. Of course, that's one of them. It's more liberal show than Teaneck, but there you go. Okay, let's move on. I read this book over Shabbos. I told you about it, Boyarin's book. Yeshiva Days, Learning on the Lower East Side. It's a great Shabbos read. I have to say that I really have an appreciation for the yeshiva MTJ. Because your sense when you read the book, and it's a very interesting book as an anthropologist. I mean, he makes some errors. In fact, one of them, I don't know how he makes it. He doesn't really come from an Orthodox background, but he's been learning for a number of years. He doesn't know what Chol V'Yisrael is. He can't really explain it properly. But what you get from this book is the uniqueness of MTJ in that it really is a place just to learn Torah. When you think of Haredi yeshivas today, you think of the big yeshivas, often hashkafa and das tayir, das teira, all the things. And in MTJ, this is the sense you get. It's just Torah. No shita of doctrine, of politics, of this and that, just Torah. And there's a sense of tolerance for different views. You could be a Zionist there. You could be a Hasid. You could be all that. And I find it's the sort of place that I would be very happy if I was living in New York to go there. You know, in the yeshiva world, I use the term hashkafa. Not hashkafa, hashkafa. That's what they call it in the Litvish yeshivas, the Das Teira and all that. But in one of the criticisms of that, someone writes the expression, ein hashkafa el ra'ah. There's no hashkafa except for bad. It's a criticism of the Lithuanian yeshiva world. What does that mean? It actually is, if you look in Breishis, just a few weeks ago in Parshas Vayera, the pasuk says, V'yashkifu al pnei Sodom. And what does Rashi say there? Kol hashkafa shebamikra l'ra, chutz mei hashkifa miyon kachecha. That every time the word hashkafa is used, except for that one case, it's always negative. So, that's what some smart person said about the Lithuanian Torah word, their hashkafa. By the way, one other thing you get from this book is that there's smart alecks at MTJ. And that's the old tradition. I know the younger people have a hard time with this, but you're always going to have smart alecks. Whenever you're trying to train people, be independent-minded, which is the old Lifisha way, you're always going to have people with their own ideas. We saw in the classes on the Shanghai. The students revolted and said, we're not going to listen to the Das Torah. We want to go to Shanghai. You're always going to have that. You can't have Hasidim, and you can't have yes people if you want to create Gedolei Yisrael. You want to create great Torah scholars. You need to have independent-minded people. And therefore, whenever you have independent-minded people, you're always going to have people with their own ideas, independent. And he describes a couple of smart alecks in the book. But that's par for the course for the Litvish world. In terms of, so one of you asked me about Rav David, is it true he really didn't write? We don't have, maybe they'll publish, but if you want to get a sense of his psakim, the best thing is this book, two volumes. It's called Vidibarta Bum. It's, look how thick it is. This is volume two. It's written by a student. His name is Baruch Moskowitz. That's Bum, Baruch Moskowitz. He's the son of the late Irving Moskowitz, who gave all that money to you know, expand Jerusalem into the Arab side, settlements, etc. In every tshuva here, he records things that he heard from his Rebbe, Rav David. So, okay, two more things. Howard Handler writes to me that, first of all, let me get the screen up a minute again. Where are we on the screen here? Okay. On the screen, this is the page just we dealt with Rabbi Shailat. I told you he goes up to Har HaBayit. We saw the picture. So someone asked me, well, don't Merkaz people not go to Har HaBayit? No, it's not true. There's a split among Merkaz. And he has an article. You can read the article here in which he explains why he goes up. And he says there, see who'd have changed his mind. He said, if Rav Gorin tells you where you can go, then you can go. I forgot to mention that his name, Shailat, is from Shivisa Yashem Wanegdi Tamid. But I hear, by the way, someone's sound is on. I can't see. So if someone could please put off the sound. I made a mispronunciation. Thank you to Howard. I pronounced this, I said, I don't know Italian, but I said that it's Hebrew. I said it's written Riki. I said, I thought it was, maybe it's Ricci. It turns out it's not. I should have known that because Ponte Vecchio. If you go to the Ponte Vecchio in Venice, that's also C-C-H-I. On the other hand, I was confused because this guy, in Italian, that's pronounced Ricci. Who is Matteo Ricci? Matteo Ricci is the Jesuit first Jesuit in China. He's the one that really had the first contact with the Kaifeng Jews. When I was in China, I tracked down his grave and I took a picture of it because it's on a communist school grounds. And I sent it to my colleagues because I work at a Jesuit university. The other thing, two other things that Howard told me, I mentioned that thou shalt not kill is a mistranslation, and I said it's in the King James Version. Howard, thank you for pointing out that the Rashbam already mentions this, the fact that thou shalt not kill in Latin goes back to the Vulgate, and thank you for that. And the last thing is he says that I should give credit, which I will right now, and this will then end what we're going to do here, to the late Jose Faur. We lost so many important people this year, 2020. It's really unbelievable. And one of them was Jose Faur. And he, in his book on the Mishnah Torah, Iyunim b'Mishnah Torah, he already points out page 146. I believe that's the page. Yes, 146. He speaks about this itikad and what it means, that it's not really proof, but it's something you're convinced with. Things we spoke about. Okay, so that's all I want to say. We have one more thing before we go. So someone asked me about what Reb Chaim of Brisk said. Remember we spoke about, I told you that on the simple understanding what the Rambam means, belief in God, there's a problem that Chassidei Kreskes already points out. What do you mean? How could you command belief in God? Who's the commander? And once you already assume that there's a commander, there's a God commanding you to believe, you already believe. So there's no command. We spoke about what the Rambam means when he uses that term itikad. Reb Chaim held, this is mentioned by his son, it was recorded by Reb Shach in the Avi Ezri, that Reb Chaim held that the word emuna, you don't use the word emuna for something that you know or something is obvious. You use it for something that the seichel doesn't lead to, like something which you can't understand through your seichel, just on faith. And that's actually a very nice interpretation. It can be used to explain maybe the Sefer Achinuch and others who really count belief. But for the Rambam, no. For the Rambam, there's no such conception of just belief. Everything either has an absolute proof or proofs that lead you to strong reason to suggest. Otherwise, it's not a commandment. There's no such existentialism type commandment for the Rambam. Okay, so thank you, Howard. Okay, everyone, we are now picking up. Let me put this down. I'm told when I put my head down, it's hard to hear. So, okay, we're continuing in the Igros Malchei Rabbanon. Rabbanan. Page 226, Siman Kuf Gimel. And before we go further, I have to make a few introductions. Let me take out my papers that we'll need here. We're going to be looking at the Siddur. Because I asked Rav Mazuz, we spoke about Rav Mazuz. I forgot to mention that he's the Rosh Yeshivas Kisei Racham, which is, with its different branches, is really the largest now of the Sephardic yeshivas. You have Chazon Avadya for Rav Yosef, and then you have Porat Yosef. But if you include Kisei Rachamim and its branches, I believe it's, because the other yeshivas don't have branches, it's the largest with still teaching the old traditional Sephardic curriculum. I spoke a little bit about it last week. We'll speak more. Here, let me show you another picture of him with yours truly. Here he is. That's an image of his father, the Rav Atzliach Mazuz, who was killed by a Palestinian terrorist in Tunis in 1971. In last week's Torah newsletter, whatever you call it, first of all, when you read it, it's amazing. He knows Tanakh by heart. There's no one else like this, where every other paragraph he's just quoting verses as part of his speaking. But just to give you a sense of why he's sort of not in the Haredi world, he's like in the middle, is he says on page one, note two, he's talking about what happened in B'nai Brak, and he says that this person was Yirei Shamayim, but he was part of Maftal. Azma, so what? Yish Maftal Nikim. They're members of the National Religious Party, Shehem Haredim lo pachot me'Haredim hayom, that they're just as religious as the Haredim. A couple of weeks ago, in number 231, he says as follows, because he's a big believer in not for kol for everyone, just for elites, and against the yeshiva world that everyone has to be in kol. He says as follows, he says, there are those who say that I speak, he mentions the Ari, and then he says the Ari, Rav Yitzchak Gloria, made a living from his own hands. He worked. And then he says, they say about me that I'm against Kolo students. He says, I never said that. He says, we have 100 students, Kolo students, and we pay, give them money. But we also make them take tests. And then he says, would that every Kolo pay them like we did? He said, but I, Dibarti Neged Ego Sheyo Shvim B'Kolo. He says, I spoke against those who sit in Kolo, and they don't do tests, and they get money. Basically, they just spend their time there to waste their time, or as a draft dodge, just because it's a cultural decision in that community, you have to go to Kolo. And then he says, these people who just sit in the Kolo and are not really focused, serious, they're just doing it as part of their lifestyle. What about the fact that they signed the ketubah to say, Ana Aflach, the Izon Vokir Farnes, that I have to support my wife? And he says, what kind of support is that? You're sitting in a Kolo and you're relying on your wife and you're getting a few, he calls them Grushin, you know, a little bit of money. And then he goes on to say that how hard the wife works and you're just sitting around. He says you have to go out and get a work and get a job. What does the Rambam say? The Rambam says you should work 3 hours a day and then learn 9 hours a day. And he quotes his father that would that it were the opposite today, that we actually learn 3 hours a day and work 9 hours a day. And he goes on how the Amoraim and the Tanaim, they all worked. And the rabbi of Gerba, Bugit Sadon, who he refused to take money. He used to sell at Rogim and other things to make money. And then he goes on and on. Rav Kaduri, he used to work. He bound books, et cetera, et cetera. And he says that all you people in Kolel, unless you're like going to be the superstars, you if you have a good voice, become a chazan. Give shiurim. Do what you can to support yourself. So this is obviously not a position that really works so well in the Haredi world. So I wrote to him the question. But before we get to the question, let me introduce you something here. I'm going to pull up on this. Let's get the screen up again. Okay, we have a blessing. When you Birkas HaChama, but also when you see lightning. Here you see it. Baruch Ata Hashem, Alkein Ma'achlam, Osem Ma'aseh Bereishis. Okay, what does this mean, Osem Ma'aseh Bereishis? The word Osem. First of all, we have to find out if there's under the sin, is there a segel or a seire? I looked at all the sidurim in my house. I have sacks, berm bound, sim shalom. Sim shalom is the conservative center. So you don't see it on my bookcase. I have to hide it behind. But it's important for me to have it. And that's actually different than the old. If you looked at the sitter, the conservative sitter that was in use for decades, the little black one, I forget who edited it. It's basically the same as the Orthodox sitter, except for they take out references to sacrifices, like even in Shemona Esrei. But the Sim Shalom is a completely new sitter. I have the new RCA sitter. Incidentally, you're going to see, I don't think you're going to see today, you'll see next class, how not only Rav Mazuz, but also yours truly, are in the new RCA sitter. Try to find it for next week if you want, because it's the letter that we're going to see, either this class or next class, that is responsible for something in the new RCA sitter. So that's my claim to fame, I guess. All these sidurim I just mentioned in this bracha have a segel, like we see right now, Osem Aseh Bereishis. However, the Matsuda sitter, and if you have a Matsuda sitter, you can take it out. Matsuda sitter, I like it very much. It's a interlinear sitter. That has a seire on it. Blackman Mishnayos that I have on my shelf over there has a seire. The Art Scroll Talmud has a segel, but the Art Scroll Mishnayos have a seire. What's the difference? What's the difference between two vocalizations? Well, if there's a segel, then the word should be translated in the present tense. Oseh Ma'aseh Bereishis. We'll get the translation in a minute. When I say present, and we're going to speak about Tanakh as well in a few minutes, really, Biblical Hebrew does not know tenses like past, present, and future, although we use that. Biblical Hebrew has the participle. This is the participle. And then you have what's the perfect and the imperfect. But it basically, generally, equals what we call the present tense. Okay, so you look at this bracha here, Oseh Ma'aseh Bereishis. That should be translated as the who creates creation, or we'll get to how that's translated, the work of creation. Who creates or is creating the work of creation. However, if there's a seire there, then it should be, it's a noun in the construct form, and it would be maker of heaven and earth. I found a mistake in the JPS translation. JPS, the old JPS, I don't know, new JPS, if you look in verse 15 here, Bruchim Atem L'Adonai, blessed ye of the Lord, Osei Shamayim V'aretz, who made heaven and earth. That's incorrect, though. It's not past tense, who made heaven and earth. Well, we'll see in a minute why they translate that. Okay, so let's go back now to this bracha and see if the translations follow, translations follow the rule. Art Scroll, we're going to see, by the way, today as well, Art Scroll does an amazing thing. It gets something right that no one else gets right. I try to be honest. I'll criticize Art Scroll today, but Art Scroll does something which is brilliant and no one else gets it right. Art Scroll has a segel, translates, who makes the work of creation. Okay, maybe not the most felicitous translation, but it's correct. The new RCA translates, who makes the phenomena of creation. Okay, I don't like that either, but I think I like Art Scroll better. Sacks, Rabbi Sacks, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, I have this sitter here. What I'm telling you now, I wrote when he was alive, so I'm not doing anything improper within a period shortly after his passing, but I have to say that there's a lot of mistakes in his sitter in terms of the translation. And he makes a mistake here as well. He translates this verse as author of creation. In other words, he makes Oseh the noun when it's in the construct. It's not. It's a verb there. So there's no way it can be Oseh Ma'aseh Bereishis can be author of creation. Sim Shalom, by the way, the conservative one, also makes it source of creation. That's a mistake. So Art Scroll gets it right. However, what do you do about in the Art Scroll Siddur in Pasuka de Zimra, we have this verse. Let me see. Psalm 146. By the way, Joe Biden the other day, he pulled a Trump because he said the palm and the palmist. I don't know where he got that from. This S is not silent. Here. Sometimes S is silent. You can go on YouTube and you can see Obama when he referred to Marine Corps. No one told him that the S in that is silent. So we can all make mistakes. But here's this verse in 6. Look in verse 6 here. We all know this. We say this all the time. Oseh shamayim va'aretz. Who made heaven and earth? That's how they translate it. But again, this is JPS. It's the problem. It's not Art Scroll. If you look in Art Scroll in Pasuk de Zimra, they translate this pasuk mistakenly, maker of heaven and earth. Again, it can't be that because it's a verb. Sachs gets it right here. Who made, Sachs gets it wrong. It follows JPS. Who made heaven and earth? Now, why do I say this is not correct? Well, first of all, it's a participle. But look in this parak of Tehillim. The very next verse, that same verse, Hashomer Emet Olam, keepeth truth forever. Next verse, Osem Mishpat Lashukim, executes judges for the oppressed. Pokeach Ivrim, Ohev Tzadikim, Shomer Et Agerim. Everything is participle. So, of course, this would also be participle. But why do they translate it made, not make? Because what does it mean to make heaven and earth? This is something that happened in the past, right? So why would it be, it has to be past. It's not present. No, this pasuk implies the continuing work of creation, just like you see in the Seder HaMachadish B'Tuvah B'Chayim Tami in Maaseh Bereishis. God is, he recreates, as it were, every day Maaseh Bereishis. That's what this pasuk is saying. And arts give credit to the RCA, new RCA Seder, alone among all the Sidurim, it translates it, who makes heaven and earth. That's how it has to be translated. Let me give you another example. This is all working our way up to what I asked her of Mazuz. This is a bracha we say in Shmoneh Esrei. We say, B'shalem recha brachim tashuv, etc., etc. Baruch ata Hashem, bonei Yerushalayim. There's a seirei under the nun. It doesn't say bonei, it says bonei. So what does that mean? Since there's a seirei under it, it means it's not a verb. It's a noun. An Art Scroll correctly translates it as builder of Jerusalem. And also the new RCA, Birnbaum and Metzida, gets it right. However, Sachs and also the Solopu and Sim Shalom are mistaken. Sachs renders Bonei Yerushalayim as if there's a segel. He translates it as who builds Jerusalem. Well, actually, no, that's, who builds Jerusalem. I guess that maybe that is correct. Builder of Jerusalem, who builds Jerusalem. So I take that back. That would work, I guess. So then what does Goel Yisrael mean? The very next bracha. Does it mean Redeemer of Israel? Do all the blessings follow this model? What about Chonen Adat? Art Scroll translates Giver of Wisdom, seeing it as a noun. Sachs has it as a verb, Chonen Adat, who graciously grants wisdom. So you have to. The question is, what do all these things mean? Are they nouns? Are they verbs? Is there consistency? What about, let me show you another one here. Mechaye Metim. Let me show you here. How do you translate? I forgot to share it here. This will share. How do you translate this bracha at the end? The last one, V'nemar atalcha yesh mesim, Baruch Hashem, mechaye hamesim. Is that a verb? Art Scroll translates it, who resuscitates the dead. Art Scroll thinks it's a verb. Sachs agrees. But the Matsuda Siddur has it as a noun, resurrector of the dead. And really, that's how what I believe it should be. Because mechaye would be for example, in the previous paragraph. That's the verbal form. So I don't want to spend too much time on that. We can go through it. Mitsuda is consistent in everything. They make it as if it's a noun form. Others are not so clear whether it goes back and forth. You could take a look and you can read what I wrote online. I don't want to spend the time. It's not so simple to understand it while I'm speaking here. The question, though, I asked Rabbi Mazuz is, problem is, there's a few places in Tanakh where the word oseh has a say race, so oseh. As Ashkenazim say, oseh. Sephardim, by the way, pronounce seyre and segol the exact same way. That's how modern Israelis do it. If you ask an Israeli how to say book in Hebrew, he'll say sefer. This isn't just an Israeli thing. This is actually the old Sephardic way. So there's no difference for Sephardim. If you tell them they have to repeat Parsha Zachar twice because you have Zecher, Zecher, they wouldn't know what you're talking about because they pronounce Seyre and Segel the exact same way, Zecher, Zecher. So when you hear an Israeli say Sefer, it's not an Israeli modern thing. It's the old Sephardic way of doing it. But you have examples where it seems clear that it's a... it's a verb, even though it has the seyre. So what Ramazuz, I don't need to give the details because we don't want to get too technical, but Rabbi Mamazuz says to me just that he explains, one, that it could be the not really a verb, but a noun. And the others, he says, you have to say that the seyre sometimes is in place of a segel. There's always going to be exceptions in the Hebrew language. So if you go through Shemona Esrei and you go through all of them and you conclude, for example, Mechayei HaMeitim, what does it mean? It means the resuscitator of the dead, and you try to put them all together and all the other brachas, you're going to come to some, there's going to be some inconsistencies. That's just the way it is with Hebrew grammar. But I do think that when you get to the word Mechayei, where you think that it should be a verb, it shouldn't be with a seyre, it should be a segel if you want. Tilas Hashem, for instance, uses a segel. This is the siddur from Rome, the old Italian nusach, that has it with a segel. So let's leave with this. I don't want to get too much into grammar, but next time when you're in shul on Shabbos, take a look at how these are translated. There's no question that Sachs is wrong on these translations. He's translating, and Art Scroll is correct, and RCA is correct. He's translating things as verbs that are really nouns. We're going to see another example where Sachs makes a mistake in a little bit. The next question is number 104. And he asked a simple question to Rabbi Mazuz. We have a bracha in Shemona Esrei. It's called Birkas Adminim. Well, we say it three times a day. If you're an Ashkenazi, you can look at it, etc. The Gemara says that this was written by Shmuel HaKatan at the direction of, was it Rabbi Gamliel, I believe, against the heretics. Who are these heretics? The Minim, we usually assume that these are the early Judeo-Christians. Now, there's been a lot written on the Minim, who the Minim were. In fact, I just saw a new article that came out about it. But let's assume it's the Judeo-Christians. Problem is, when you look at this paragraph, it's called Birkas HaMinim, but there's nothing in it about the Minim. If you read it, it says, the slanderers, and then evil. So there's nothing in there about Minim. If you look at Art Scroll doesn't know what to make. Art Scroll has this whole thing that it Malshinim, because they were the heretics. It's all nonsense. No medieval text, no original text has Malshinim. Malshinim is from the censors. All the original texts have, it begins Vela Mashumadim and then Minim. Those are the two words. In fact, in some, it doesn't say Mashumadim. It actually has Notzrim, Christians. The Sephardim have it half right. They have Vela Mashim, they take out Mashumadim. But they still have Minim. I think because in the Min was understood to refer to Christians. So in the Sephardic world, you can refer negatively to people who become Christians, that they should be uprooted. But you couldn't say that about apostates to Islam. So instead, the word was changed. Until our day, no Sidurim corrected this. Or so I wrote in my book, Changing the Immutable. Even the Rinat Yisrael, which did a lot to update and correct, did not change it. Then it was pointed out to me, however, that there are Siddurim, for example, if you look in this Siddur, this is published in Vienna about 7 years ago. Let's see, I believe it's in Vienna in 2016. This wasn't pointed out to me. Another Siddur was. I saw this when I was in Vienna. This is by one of the rabbis in the Vienna community, and it gets rid of all the censorship. Everything's exact. And if you look in the Shmoneh Esrei, he has it right. That's the original version of it. So I asked Rav Mazuz, because he published a Siddur. It's called the Siddur HaMaduyak. It's an exact Siddur in terms of the Sephardic Nusach with explanations on where they got everything. It's really detailed. And yet that still has the classic Sephardic version, which is, I think it's I think that's what it is. So why not go back? Why are we still using a false text? And it doesn't really have a good answer. He says, yes, the original version is Mashum Adim, but this has been totally forgotten. It's been taken out. And he mentions also everywhere the Gemara, if you look in the original Gemaras, they have the word Mashumad, but it was changed to Mumar. I don't know why Mumar was thought not as bad as Mashumad, but so he says, we say Laminiv Lamashinim, because that also includes some Mashumadim, and because a Min and a Mashumad, the same thing, even the Minim, reject the oneness of God. And of course, and he says the Mashinim, the slanderers, did all sorts of bad things to the Jews. He doesn't really answer my question as to why not do the original version. Yaakov Chmielewski used to do the original version, even though no Siddurim in his day had it. Why? My question to Rav Mazuz is, his Siddur is the Siddur HaMaduyak, which I have behind me. Maybe later I'll get it up and show you some things in it. But if you're going to have a Siddur HaMaduyak, they corrected all the other problems in the Siddur, why keep that? I have to say, he doesn't really have a good answer to that. Yes, and the Siddur I was looking at is by Rabbi Shlomo Hofmeister of Vienna, yes. Okay, so that's Siman Kuf Zion. Now we get to Siman Kuf Chet. Let me show you. Let me pull up something for you here. I'm going to show you something you all know, or you think you know, because here we have Adon Olam. Don't we all know Adon Olam? Why Archgold doesn't put it at the end of davening? I don't know. As far as I know, it's pretty universal, at least in the modern Orthodox shuls, say it in a davening. But okay, let me enlarge this a bit so you see it. Famous Adon Olam. What do the first words mean of Adon Olam? That's my question for you. Wait a second. Hold on, I skipped a page. I skipped. I couldn't believe I skipped something. We're going to go back to that. Let me go back to that because I skipped something. I don't want to go out of order. By mistake, I turned two pages and I skipped. So let's stop there. But the other ones are quick. I don't know if we'll get to Adon Olam, but Siman 104. I asked them something. It's not the sort of thing it's easy to explain unless you have a Mishnayos in front of you. But I quoted something that Shadal, Shmuel David Gatzato, said. And I just want to know if he bought it, a new interpretation of the Mishnah. And he says about Shadal, so obviously he knows Shadal. He knows Shadal backwards and forwards. The typical Ashkenazi Torah scholar, if they've even heard of Shadal, they've never read it. Rav Mazuz knows Shadal backwards and forwards, but he says, Hachacham Shadal, Osa Chadashos Ba Mochamos. He does new things and he creates trouble, basically. He says that he, in some places, he disputes with the interpretations of Chazal. And he does Osek Zarato Halacha L'maaseh. And he does his view even in practice. That's true about Shadal. I'll tell you what he's alluding to here. Shadal sometimes interprets although he's regarded as Orthodox in the Torah world, in modern Orthodox world, they like to quote him and everything, but there are there's one I know in particular. He interprets the verse that against shaving with a razor. He says that it only applies, I think he says only applies to the kohanim or a veil. I think that's what he says. And it doesn't apply the way we understand, the way Chazal understand it, that it applies to everyone. And he says that halacha amaisa, I adopted this for me. So when you see a picture of Chagall, he doesn't have a beard. He tells us in a letter that he shaved with a razor because he thought that was pshat in the pasuk. Now that's, on the other hand, Chagall was, he trained all the rabbis of Italy. He was like, and this was a private, I guess you could say, idiosyncrasy that he says in a letter. And he says, I don't paskin this because I'm not a posek. You know, he doesn't go around telling people what to do. But privately, he thinks that this is the pshat. Well, the Rashbam came up with all sorts of pshats on what the halacha is. According to the Rashbam, the pshat is a tefillin is not to be taken literally. Rashbam says that when you free, you know, you're not supposed to free the slave. He says, well, then to Yovel, you could free, you're supposed to free the Yovel. This, the Rashbam has many examples where he interprets, but he doesn't do it in practice. He's saying that's the pshat. So Chagall's a problem. I have to be honest, Chagall's a problem. If you want to use him, I included him in my book, The Limits of Orthodox Theology, because he's been part of the canon, even though he has some unusual views. But he also says, nevertheless, there are times that he stood firm against the maskilim, and therefore people treat him with respect. For instance, he was the primary person arguing against the idea of the Deutero-Isaiah, that there are two Isaiahs. And he gave very strong arguments against there being two Isaiahs. So Rav Mazuz doesn't like this second Isaiah, so therefore Chagall, in that sense, has to be praised. The two Isaiah, it's not really a dogmatic, doctrinal thing. In the Rabbinical Seminary of Berlin, Professor Barth, who was Zvi Hildesheimer's son-in-law, he was a great Bible scholar, he taught the second Isaiah to all the students at the Berlin Rabbinical Seminary, Ibn Ezra. You look at the beginning of Perek 40, Mem. Ibn Ezra says that he alludes to it, as he always does, but it's a different prophet. Hertz somewhere writes, Hertz in his Peyrus on Chumash writes, this is not an issue. And it's not an issue. What's the difference, really? At least I don't think so. Nachamu, Nachamu Ami. Yeah, you could say it's a prophecy, but whatever. It's not really, at least the Rabbinical Seminary of Berlin didn't think it was dogmatic. The next tshuva, we'll get to the Adon Olam, is also a quick one. I asked him a few questions. Most of them are not of interest to us, except for this. I asked him about the minhag in Tunisia. Why do we ask him that? Because I found first Tunisia. Hold on. He's going to tell us that even today, what I'm going to ask him about is the minhag in Tunis that we're going to speak about right now. And if you're wondering, Tunis, minhag, what's going on? There's Yidden in Tunis. Let me show you a good picture here. Here is the synagogue of Tunis, the main one. There's more than one. There's two functioning shuls in Tunis. This is the shul, and look, it has the tetragrammaton right on the front. I took this picture when I was there less than a year ago, January. I was there before I flew to Morocco. Some of you were with Morocco with me. We're told in the Ashkenazic world, in Europe, you know that only the reformers put the tetragrammaton on the shul like that. I mentioned that on our Central Europe trip until we get to Prague. In Prague, you see that they also did it on the flag. But generally, this is the reformers, and the Orthodox rabbis were very upset with this. But not all, so let me show you. I didn't take a picture of the big show in there, but there's a little base medrash. And if you go to Tunis today, you have a nice here's like the little base medrash on the side of the show. Let me show you close up. Let me take a picture close up. You have a school there for boys and a school for girls, and the kids come together every night and they learn. It's not as religious a community as Jerba, by no means. They're typical Sephardim, like if you know Syrians, other thing typical. Like, for example, I was with someone and we walk out of the shul and he put something in his pocket. They never would do that in Jerba. Jerba, they're so machped. They have an air of, some of the people in Tunis are very observant. Others are just whatever. They're observant, but they're not super observant. So this is, this was, I took this in Tunis and this was before Mincha in the evening. The kids come together to learn extra. So there's still a community there with a school and food and the butcher shop, which is right near the shul. I couldn't believe it. I'm walking down with my baseball hat, my Torah in motion, my blue one, if you know that, because no one knows. Only once in all my travels, this guy in Amsterdam a year and a half ago, I'm on the train thing, and he starts talking to me. He says, oh, you must be Jewish. I see your hat. But no one knows what Torah in motion, Torah means, I guess. So I'm wearing it. I don't have a problem. And lo and behold, this guy with the big black yarmulke is right there, right in front of the butcher store. So I'm speaking to him. I said, he comes from Gerba. He's the butcher. And I said, isn't it a problem? You're walking around the street with the yarmulke. He said, no, everyone knows me. And I don't know, because about 6 months before that, there was a big rally right in front of that show, an anti-Israel rally. So I would never wear the yarmulke. Will I wear it when I go to the UAE? I don't know. They said you could wear the kippah everywhere you go in the UAE. So I'll let you know. The question I asked him was follows. Now, if you look in the response of Yisrael Moshe Chazan from Eretz Yisrael and then in Rome, he was the Rebbe of Rome. We did classes with him on Torah Moshe. We're going to get back to the classes on great rabbis. There's going to be a surprise, the ones when we finish with the Sefer. I just started today. He's a gadol, but not a sort of the gadol that many people think. I found in the Krach Shal Romi, he describes this as follows, what the Avelim would do. And I wanted to know, was this the practice when you were growing up in Tunis? He says as follows, that everyone would come daven on Shabbos in the house of the mourner, the house of the Avel. We don't do that. The Avel comes to shul. And after Shemona Esrei, the of Shabbos, I assume in Shacharis or maybe Musaf, I don't know. He just says Achar HaMida, the guy who gives the eulogy would stand up, the Dorish Ilu Nishmas Hameis, and would give a hesped on Shabbos for the dead person. And everyone comes to this house to hear that. Do we have it? In Ashkenazic world, do we ever do hesped on Shabbos? I don't know. I've never heard it. I've never seen it. I can't imagine it. And we don't do davening at the house of the Avel anyway on Shabbos generally, although we mincha we would sometimes, but we would not Shabbos morning. And then he says, after, this is Shacharis actually, because it says, then they go to the shul, the Yer Kriyas HaTorah. And Rishon Moshe Chazan says he doesn't remember if the Avelim themselves will go hear Kriyas HaTorah or not. So I asked Rav Mazuz, this is an interesting practice that you go daven Shacharis at the house, and then you even do, I guess you stay for Musaf at the shul, but you do the Hesped at the house Shabbos morning, and you daven at the house of the Avel. And he says, this is also the Minhag today in Tunis. But he says that the hesped, the drasha on the niftar, we do it in the afternoon in his house. And he says the Avelim today do go to shul to hear Kriyas HaTorah, or they bring the Torah to their house. But so in Tunis to this day, they'll do Shabbos during the Shiva. They'll have a drasha or hesped of, sometimes you don't know the difference between drasha and hesped because the whole hesped is all a drasha. But usually the drasha is supposed to pull in things about the person who passed away. You can hear about it incidentally. They just put on Hespedim 30 days for Rav David Feinstein, MTJ, on their website. MTJ has a website that shows you also. It's not a typical Haredi yeshiva. I was informed of this by the administrator of it because thanks to Baruch, who told me that MTJ came out with this big volume a couple of years ago, which gives the whole history. I ordered it today. You have to make a nice donation. I made a donation and they're sending it out to me. So hopefully by next week, I'll have information about exactly MTJ, when it was founded, et cetera. Okay, so now the last thing, then next one was Birkas Aminim we did. This will be the last one we get to today, Adon Olam. So next week, we'll get to where Rav Mazuz and I appear in the RCA Siddur. But let's go back to the Adon Olam here. And let's figure this out. So here you have Adon Olam. So what does Adon Olam mean? The first words. I'm going to tell you something now that I have found is not only is completely unknown in regular Jewish circles, I've even found Tanakh experts, not academic scholars, Tanakh experts who were shocked when I told them this, and maybe for good reason because Rav Mazuz doesn't accept it. But here's what I'm telling you. If you look in all the dictionaries, the Bible dictionaries, BDB, BDB is Brown, Driver, and Briggs, and all the others, you will find that all the modern biblical scholars agree the word olam does not mean world in Tanakh. You cannot find anywhere in Tanakh where the word olam means world. Rather, what does olam mean? It means eternity. And we'll see examples of this. So that then raises the question, what does Adon Olam mean? Is it using olam in the rabbinic sense, the Mishnaic sense, where it means eternity? Where it means world, Adon Olam? Or is it being used as eternal? I'm just looking, I opened up to the RCA sitter, that has eternal master. But look at what Art Scroll has, master of the universe. Now, before getting into any more detail, I just think if you just look at the translation, what does it say? Master of the universe who reigned before any form was created, at the time when his will brought all into being, then as king was his name proclaimed. After all has ceased to be, he, the awesome one, will reign alone. I think it's clear just on Peshat, it has to be eternal. You're saying eternal Lord who reigned before anything was created, he brought everything into being when no one was around. After all has ceased to be, he will still exist. If you just look at Adon Olam Peshat, I think it's obvious that it means it's referring to God's eternity. Hu haya, hu hoveh, hu yeh. He was, he will, is, and will be. B'li reshit, b'li tachlit. He has no beginning, no end. So leaving aside, the word olam as that it could mean world. Everyone knows it could also mean eternal. So even if you think that in Tanakh it could mean world, I think from Pshat, if you look at Adon Olam, the Pshat is obvious, at least to me. You can disagree if you want, that it can only mean eternal world. And that's how the new RC, eternal master, eternal Lord, whatever. That's how Birnbaum has it also. The new RCA, also De Sola Pool. De Sola Pool was the sitter commissioned by the RCA. It never really took off. It never was that popular. Some shuls did it. It was only for Shabbos. That was a problem. And also Birnbaum. Birnbaum was a better sitter. So Birnbaum became very popular. So I asked, though, Rav Mazuz about this. And I'm going to point out something else in the Adon Olam in a second. But where Art Scroll, and this I tell you they get wrong, at least I think. But then they get something so right. They got to be given all the credit. But I wrote to Rav Mazuz because he has notes on a poem of Yehuda HaLevi. And there he speaks about this as referring to master of the world. So I write to him, first of all, I don't get it. Olam only means in Tanakh, it never means world. It only means eternal. And I was assuming when I wrote that the poem was using biblical terminology, but also the form, the whole thing seems to refer to eternity. He writes to me this view that Olam only means eternity. That's the view of the Chokrim HaAchronim. In other words, that's the view of the modern biblical scholars. Sha'olam b'tanach perusho netzach. That olam in Tanakh means eternity. The modern biblical scholars say that the word tevel, that's how you say world. But he says, and this is where it gets interesting, I'm not sure if I agree with him. He says, Chazal did not understand it like this. And he brings a proof, two proofs. First, he brings a proof from Brachos. The Gemara in Brachos 54a says as follows in the Mishnah, not the Gemara. Mishakilkulu hatzadukim v'amru ein olam el echad hiskinu shehu amri min olam v'ad olam. What this means is, I have an English translation here. When the originally they used to say in the Beis Hamikdash just le'olam, but when ad olam, they say in one of the Brachos. But when the Sadducees said that there's only one world, the Sadducees didn't believe in a world to come. Therefore, what did the rabbis decree? That instead of saying just the word ad ha'olam, instead we should say min ha'olam, the ad ha'olam, from including that this world and the next world. So he's saying that we see that Chazal understood olam as referring to this world and the next world. and therefore there's no reason to assume they wouldn't use it here, olam, in that way. Well, that doesn't really answer my question. Of course, Chazal understood olam as being both of them. So that's obvious. But my assumption was that that this is using biblical terminology. But then he gives another example. He says, don't tell me that even in the Torah, or in Tanakh, olam only means eternity. He gives this example. He cites a pasuk. Here is chapter 89 of Tehillim, verse 3. Ki amarti, for I have said, olam chesed yibaneh. So if you look at the JPS translation here, forever is mercy built. His mercy is around forever. However, if you look at the Gemara, and it's quoted by Rashi here in Vayikra, we have in Yud Zayin, what does the Pasuk say? It's a prohibition on taking your sister. You can't marry your sister. And what does it say? It says, "V'isha sheyikach atzachosu basavivu basimov v'rasev v'rasav isir aser v'so chesed hu." This word chesed is an unusual word because usually we think of chesed as mercy or something like that. But chesed here means disgrace. You look at BDB and he explains that word. So it's a disgrace. What does Rashi say, quoting the Gemara? Chesed hu? Lashon Arami, cherpa. First he says that it means cherpa, disgrace. Chasuda. What's the midrash? He says, if you're going to say, Tomar, Kayan, you're going to say, what? It says you can't marry a sister, but what about Kayan? We're told that there was girls born also. Kayan married his sister. What does it say? Chesed asa ha-mokom. We've no salamoim menu. The omnipresent, or God, in permitting this marriage, performed an act of kindness. Shinemar, what's the proof? Olam chesed yibaneh, the world is built on kindness. So the midrash, actually it's a midrash, I don't remember if it's more a midrash, uses that verse, olam chesed yibaneh, to say, sees it as world. That is, God gave mercy to the world, and in this case, he allowed someone to marry the sister so that they could bring a progeny to the world. So Rav Mazuz says here that we see that at least Chazal, unlike the modern scholars, interpreted olam sometimes, at least in this case, as also meaning world. I don't know. I have to say, with all respect to Rav Mazuz, I don't buy it. This is the Midrash. It's not pshat. This doesn't mean that the rabbis actually, if you'd ask them, does it really mean that? No, I think they would say no. It's pshat really is that it means forever. But we know the word can mean other things. So does that mean that they thought that the Torah meant that? We can't say. There are many times the Chazal use words that in their historical meaning wouldn't have meant that, but it comes to mean something else, so they use it. I'm not convinced that when the Midrash cites this verse, Olam Chesed Yibaneh, that they really are saying that the word in its context means world. That's all I would say to Rav Mazuz. And then he concludes by saying, the Paitan, the one who wrote Adon Olam, Mistama, he said, Kit Kavein, B'milat Adon Olam. What did he mean when he said Adon Olam? Ribono Shalom, like Chazal say. So you can look at your own on Shabbos or anytime during this week, look at Adon Olam. You come to your own conclusion. Is Rav Mazuz correct that Adon Olam means Ribono Shel Olam, as Art Scroll has it? Or like I think, and all the other Sidurim I mentioned, does Adon Olam, and if leaving aside what the word means in Chazal, etc., just look at all the sentences. Doesn't it mean eternal? Isn't that the simple meaning? Okay, it's already 9:30. We've had fun. Time flies when you're having fun. Next class will begin with going from Adon Olam to Yigdal. We're going to begin before we get to Yigdal. I want to show you. I'm not going to show you now because we're already finished. I'll begin next class. Art Scroll's genius in Adonolam, that they get it, that no one else does. I'm going to pick up with that next class, and then we're going to move on to what sort of good stuff we have coming. We have Yigdal, something that I think you'll find really interesting. Manishtana, what does Manishtana mean? And then I've been waiting, Rav Aryeh Leib, because then we'll get back to the Vilna Gaon. Halayla Hazeh. He sent me interesting stuff from a new volume that explains what's going on with the Vilna Gaon and Lila, how he sees it as feminine. And okay, all sorts of other interesting stuff we're going to get to. Let me quickly take the questions, the comments. Someone asked me which paper, not the Torah Link. It's called the Jewish Link. If you're in the New Jersey, New York area, you know what I'm talking about. It's very helpful. It has all the ads. Right this time, usually you'd have all the Pesach ads. Unfortunately, we don't have any of that, but you have all sorts of stuff, information. The Jewish Week closed. So the only way to get the ads and things is from that. Yes, Rav Aryeh Leibowitz is William Gewurz's son-in-law. He's really special, if you're interested in halacha. I spent the whole Pesach with him. Rabbi Kelman says, just today he was praying at Vartar and Tashbates, a great medieval authority, quotes a chiddush. I'm not sure.
Oh, it's coming down. It got erased. Chiddush of a Rabbanit. He quotes the Rabbanit.
Ah, okay. Yeah. Well, that's mentioned in the Chiddush, Shem HaGdolim, where at the end of it, after giving all the rabbis, he has Rabbanit, and he mentions the... See, I don't know. When the Tashbates says Rabbanit, he might mean the Rebbetzin.
Right. I couldn't figure out from the context if it means Rebbetzin or because he quoted the Chiddush she said. In other words, yeah. She said, HaRabbanit, HaRav Yosef.
I think he means Rebbetzin, but when the Chiddush includes it, he doesn't mean Rebbetzin. He means learned women, and he includes it at the end. David says, as a Renat member, I would say it's modern Orthodox, not liberal. Actually, Renat was the last shul I spoke at before the lockdown. The last Shabbos that I went to shul was at Renat. But I would say in the modern Orthodox, it's more liberal, I would think. After all, they had Mark Shapiro speak. So no, I would say it's very big on women's issues, et cetera, et cetera. So I think that's in our world today. That's on the liberal side of modern Orthodox. The rabbi, by the way, Rabbi Adler is fantastic. If people don't know Teaneck and Rabbi Adler. I don't know if other shuls in Teaneck would advertise a talk by a Rabbanit. I can tell you, I'm not going to say the name, but something that is also very modern and refused to use the word Rabbanit for a woman who had the title. So I think over time it's going to become accepted because with the Israeli thing, you know, when we have now Zoom and things from the people in Israel, they do have to call them Rabbanit. Even in my shul, or what, the other shul in West Orange, my former shul, Havas Achim, B'nai Jacob and David, they're having something on Zoom from someone in Israel. So that's a title, Rabbanit. So I don't know if the shul in person, you could have someone be called Rabbanit, but it's changing, I think. And for good reason, as I said, why should we call these people professors? They're Torah teachers. We can come up with some title. It doesn't have to be rabbi. It could be something. Howard says, yeah, President Tashmah, Nigel Shabinister. Very nice. So they're just saying Josh Hoffman said that the Aaron Kreiser used that expression, Kol HaShkafal Ara. You can keep that in mind. Rav Baruch Moskowitz was Maspid Rav David at Yeshiva Torah Vadas. So that's if you go to the MTJ .edu.com, whatever it is, .org, I think it is. Hold on, I'll tell you right now, because it'll just be .edu, mtj.edu, you'll see the Hespedim. I have to say, I was a little upset, though. They're all there for the Hespedim, and people are sitting close to each other and not wearing masks. I don't understand. Hadassah says, YU has an ad for secular studies and the two female teachers listed as doctor. Well, that's because they are a doctor. Professor is not anyone who teaches at a university can be called a professor. You don't have to have a doctorate, a PhD, or anything. So you can call people professors. The problem is with the Torah teachers, one of them who's there, they could have called doctor. She's actually an academic scholar, but you want to give a title, so I get it. But I think Rabbanit's a much better title for a Torah teacher than professor. Professor also has the implication of, you know, these what can I say, the skeptical academic types. And that's what the professor is not a Torah term. What can I tell you? There's nothing wrong with it. I have the title, but it's not a Torah term. Rabbi Soloveitchik, when he was doing philosophy, when he taught at Revel in the early years, they might then call him, I bet they called him Dr. Soloveitchik. But when he's a Rosh Yeshiva, he's not Dr. Soloveitchik. He's the Rebbe. Yes, Jose Faur. I could speak another time about Jose Faur. I knew Jose Faur. Unfortunately, he's not as well known as he should be. He had idiosyncratic views, and he was he had certain negative views about Ashkenazim. And but he comes from that world also. He was he learned in Lakewood. He carried. He was one of the people who carried Rav Aaron Kotler's coffin at the funeral. That's how close he was to Rav Aaron Kotler. But he had certain things against Ashkenazi, let's put it that way. I spoke to him about this as well. I went down to see him. He used to spend the summers in Elberon or Deal, one of those towns. And I went. We used to have correspondence. He's though he gave me all the, if you know Saul Lieberman in the Orthodox, the stuff about Faur in it. I spoke to him about this. I got it from Rabbi Shama, but then he gave me stuff. I have more stuff also subsequently. That was a big loss. Rabbi Silverman, yes, the Silverman United Synagogue sitter. Ellen says that Rinat Yisroel has seire under the sin, osei chon, okay, it's hard for me to, Yigdal, the person commenting on Yigdal, I will get to Yigdal next class, so hold on, whoever privately did it, and I'll tell you what we discovered. And how it got into the sitter, the RCA sitter. Torah in Motion just had two classes on Shadal. Yes, it did. That the Minchas Yitzchak, Rav Yitzchak Yaakov Weiss, the Yedek Haredis, he quotes Shadal in one place. You can find it. Because Shadal wrote an amazing letter against the reformers who didn't circumcise their kids. And he said, you have to throw them out. They can't even be part of the community. So Shadal, what do you do about someone who in his public life is completely not just Torah observant, a defender of Torah and an attacker? Sometimes he went too far, like he attacks the Rambam, but it came from a place of piety, like Hirsch attacked the Rambam. He didn't like philosophy. He says, I'm not interested in Kant, K-A-N-T, I want Tanakh, T-N-A-K as in Tanakh. But you have someone who in a private letter acknowledges that he violates halacha for ideological reasons because he doesn't think that's pshat. So it's interesting, and it's I don't know if that's better than someone who acknowledges he violates halacha just because he doesn't care or he's weak, or I don't know what to make of that. I mean, some people would say that that's a kofir shadal, but he's unique, put it that way. Chaim says, is it possible that they follow Rav Mesas in Tunis regarding carrying on Shabbat, and that's why someone put something in his pocket? No, that's not at all the reason. It's just that this the person who I know is not so observant. He's a he's not that learned either. He's just a what happened was when the French came into Tunisia with the Alliance schools, it led to a lot of irreligiosity. You even had some intermarriage with Christians, and you had a lot of people who were not Shomer Shabbos, and then you had a lot of people who were like the people that you think of in the 1950s, or if you live outside New York areas, who go to the modern Orthodox shuls, but are themselves not that observant. In Gerba, you have none of that because they refused to let these schools in. The rabbis refused to let the Alliance schools in. But in Tunis is like a modern Orthodox community. In my modern Orthodox community, if we didn't have an Erev, you'd still have people carrying things, and you probably have people still pushing baby carriages probably. But we have Erevs now, so you don't have that issue. Growing up, of course, we had that. Baby carriages every Shabbos. So it's not for halachic reasons. There's a, if you know the Syrian community also, you have different levels of religiosity. It's the same thing in Italy. It's the same thing. It's the same thing all over. That's how Jews always lived. And that's what you'll see today in Tunis. Rabbi, German Menhagim are different, higher than Tunis. Well, obviously there's different Menhagim, but Gerba is a much more observant place. I mentioned already, every single woman in Gerba wears a tichel, and they're very makpid. And it's because of the Alliance, they didn't allow it in. Rav Chaim Angel claims that Isaiah 2 is no longer an issue among Orthodox scholars, and it's accepted. Okay, well, if Chaim Angel says it, Chaim Angel is a great biblical scholar, and he's in the field. So I wouldn't think it would be an issue, just like I don't think dating of the Zohar is an issue, but it is an issue as you go further to the right. Mike says that Mir and Eitz Chaim and Israel have websites also. Oh, Lakewood also now has a website. I was just being tongue-in-cheek there. Olam Chesed Yibaneh, Mike says, can't mean eternal. Well, we see JPS says it's eternal and many other Tanakh. So if you look in BDB, he sees it as eternal. Yes. Okay, so someone tells me that the Azor Eliyahu Siddur, a very good Siddur, vocalizes Mechayi with a segment. That's like Divas Hashem has, and he says that that in all the old Girsos, it's with a segol. If it's with a segol, then it's a verb form. Thank you. But yes, Rav Shabtai Sofer. If you look at Rav Shabtai Sofer's Siddur, he says that everything there is with a seirei, and everyone is a noun form. Even Mechayi Meiti Matar Rav Oshia, that over there should also be a noun form that is the resurrector. So thank you for that. Howard says their Orthodox scholars should even accept Trito Isaiah. Yes, the very end of Isaiah, a third prophet. I guess, Shmuel is attributed to more than one author. Ibn Ezra already tells us, hints to the fact that it's a second Isaiah. But a third Isaiah? It's never been an Ikar. It's never an issue. It's just, it's a prophecy. So what's the matter? Same thing in Tehillim. The second half of the pasuk refers to a place, so it makes sense that the olam in the first half is also a place. Ki amarti, I said, olam chesed yibaneh, shamayim tachin menacha bahem. Forever mercy is built in the very heavens. You establish your faithfulness. Let me show everyone here the pasuk so they can see the interesting point that is being made. So Mike is saying, if you look in pasuk gimel. If the second half of the verse is saying in the heavens, you establish your faithfulness. So presumably the first half is going to be this world. For I said, Olam Chesed Yibaneh, mercy is in this world. And in the heavens, you establish your faithfulness. I don't know. It also reads well, forever is mercy built. And you read it, mercy is parallel to faithfulness. You have a problem, Mike, you and I guess Rav Mazuz, in that nowhere else. Well, I should say that maybe you can find a few where you could teach it to say it, but it's not, Olam is used all the time, and it's not like we have lots of examples. There's Ibn Ezra, I think, on this pasuk, if I recall, makes the claim that it's not just Ibn Ezra, the regular commentators, traditional medieval commentators, do read it as world. So, but if it is world, if that's the exception, then just one exception, not others? Okay, but that's Rav Mazuz. The YU catalog had one course taught by the Rav. He was listed as professor of Talmud. Yeah, the catalog. They used to, but in class, he never referred to that. But Chaim Soloveitchik was a Rosh Hashiva in the early 70s. So I'm assuming you called Chaim, you didn't call him professor, you called him rabbi, but in the afternoon, you call him professor. Rabbi Rachman would always refer to the Rav as Dr. Soloveitchik. I once asked Norman Lamb about this, and Norman Lamb didn't want to be critical, but he said that you could tell what people value by how they refer to the Rav. I don't think that for Rachman, he wanted to show that the Rav was also a great secular knowledge. That was his way of putting the Rav, praising the Rav, putting him higher than the other Rosh Yeshiva, because they all were rabbis, but the Rav was also a doctor. But I agree with Dr. Lamb. That's why I asked him, although he was called Dr. Lamb, not Rabbi Lamb, but Dan, he made his mark really not in the rabbinic world, in the other world. To refer to Rabbi Soloveitchik as Dr. Soloveitchik, you know, it seems a little, it's not fitting. It's not where he made his mark. On the other hand, you're not going to call David Berger or David Schatz, Rabbi Berger, Rabbi. They made their mark as doctors. The famous story is that people would call up Rabbi Soloveitchik's house and say, I'd like to speak to Dr. Soloveitchik. You know, his wife would answer the phone and she would say, which Dr. Soloveitchik? She was also a doctor. Okay, Mel says that his nephew's wife is Rabbanit Karmi. But if you go at Migdalos, but if you look on the Migdalos website, they don't have, I didn't see it at least. I didn't see them calling them Rabbanit. I just saw them with a their name. Okay. And finally, I skipped this. Daniel says Josefa Orr taught at JTS. Yes, Josefa Orr was one of the number of Orthodox people who taught at JTS. The old expression was that JTS had Orthodox teachers teaching conservative rabbis to minister to Reform laity. And there's a lot of truth to that, because if you go down the list, one Orthodox person after another, and yes, and it's because of Josefa Orr teaching at the seminary, that's what led to the huge controversy that he was pushed out of the mainstream community in Washington Heights. I published about this in Flatbush, the Syrian community. I wrote about this at the end of Sol Liebman, the Orthodox, and subsequently I published a new document I found, a letter from Rabbi Ben Chaim, not Kassim, the other one, I think it was Ben Chaim, who was the like the other major rabbi, not Ben Chaim, the one who wrote Magen Badi, Matlu Babadi, the author of the Tshuva, Magen Badi, who was also a leading figure in the Sephardic community. Here he was, the posek for the Syrians, great, great rabbi. He was a businessman, and when he went to work, he didn't have a yarmulke on, and he's a great halachic authority. But he also wrote a letter to Rabbi Nissim, Chief Rabbi Nissim, in defense of Rabbi Faur, that all he's doing is teaching there. Lieberman wanted to get great Orthodox scholars, and Rabbi Faur had a big influence on many, many students, and it's unfortunate that he never found his place in the community. And he had a yeshiva. He started a yeshiva in the late 50s, early 60s, where a lot of the Syrian rabbis learned there. And then he went off to Spain. He got his PhD. It's a whole story. If you don't know any of our stuff, it is recommended. With that, I think we've gone long enough for tonight.
Thank you. I'll
turn it over now to Rabbi Kelman.
No, thank you very much. We look forward to next week. Tomorrow, Simi Peters, part 5 in our introduction to Midrash, followed by Benny Gesundheit at 12:15 on, I think, the 11th part now on Sefer Tehillim, and where he does discuss the many authors of the various Tehillim. It's not much more than David HaMelech, of course. But anyway, we look forward to seeing you. And then Wednesday, Thursday, we look forward to seeing you all during the week. I just mentioned this week's Parsha Shear is Rabbi Bram Weinberg of Silver Spring, Maryland, who will be giving the Parsha Shear. And we look forward to seeing you. Be well, be healthy, and invite your friends to join in. Okay, Lila.